all seeds are beholden to their environment. Like they will not germinate and emerge and grow and develop if they do not have the right environmental conditions. Now, not all seeds need light, they don't need oxygen, but all seeds need good temperature. They have a range and they need some amount of moisture. And so when we do germination experiments, that's kind of where we start. Like, how hot is hot? How cold is cold? And if you can determine that range and those thresholds, you can sort of pin down when is this plant going to be growing and when isn't.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. A robust return on your sorghum investment is not just a dream. Learn more at doubleteamsorghum.com. KWS Hybrid Rye, seeding the future since 1856.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, happy to have on with us again Dr. Liberty Galvin. Liberty is an assistant professor of Extension Weed Science and Precision Weed Management at Oklahoma State University. That's right. She's on campus here with me. Not today, but you know, I get to work with Liberty on a regular basis. Liberty, we've had you on before, and apparently you're so good, we couldn't resist having you on again.
That's great. Thank you, Brian.
So for those that might have missed the first time, I was like, give, you know, refresher of your background. You know, what was the route from where have you been back to Oklahoma?
Yeah, so I started my agriculture journey as like a young kid. My mother's family has a cow-calf operation off I-35, close to Purcell. When I was younger, I was really into being outside. They did a lot of hard work on the farm, and I was like, wow, large animal production systems are not for me. Like, but I really, really liked being outside. And so I did my undergrad at Oklahoma State. My bachelor's degree is in environmental science, but I decided to get two minor degrees, one in soil science and one in agronomy. And I think that kind of pivoted my direction. I started really going towards agriculture and agronomy and precision agriculture instead of the environmental science route. I also really got into study abroad while I was at Oklahoma State, and that took me over to West Africa. And so a combination of like my agriculture background, my international development experience led me to the University of California, Davis. So I have a master's degree in international agricultural development. But to pay for that program, I was a grad student researcher in the weed science program, and I worked on a Roundup Ready alfalfa project. That was really cool. I found out I love weed science. And so I did a PhD in horticulture and agronomy with an emphasis in weed science, also at UC Davis. I really enjoyed my time at Davis, but I realized that I had the opportunity to get a job back in Oklahoma at Oklahoma State. And so I really aimed for that in my last couple of years at Davis. So it is a pleasure and a privilege to be back at OSU. But I do have to say the environment here is so different and it changes so, so much more frequently than the environment in California. So it's been like a big mind shift for my agronomy perspective. Yeah.
For those that don't know, we were below freezing a couple days ago and we'll be 70 something by the weekend. So we're within a 7 day time frame, we're going to go from below freezing. In fact, last week my crew tried to pull soil samples on a Bermuda grass patch outside of Stillwater and the ground was too frozen. It was 55 degrees out and they couldn't get it a probe in the ground. Now I get it if you're in Minnesota and stuff, you're used to that. But in Oklahoma, we don't typically have to worry about that. So Liberty, Let's dive into some of the stuff and we'll go into a little bit of what where you're working here, but you had a lot of work with it back at UC Davis. Talk about breaking dormancy as far as a weed and weed bank breaking dormancy and some of the stuff you've worked on.
Yeah, so a lot of my weed science experience was more applied ecology. And so the concept there is kind of how can we look at the plant's entire life cycle from seed to harvest and determine points in the growing cycle in which we can exploit. When is the plant very vulnerable? You know, a lot of people have a rule of thumb. If the weed has already gone to seed, you're out of luck with weed control. So a lot of people, including myself during my PhD, we really focus on the soil seed bank. How can we manage? So I actually like to think of it like a bank. Okay, so you get, you put in your seeds, if you let them go to seed, but ideally you want to withdraw from that bank. And I think that's a little counterintuitive because sometimes people think like, oh, well, if weed seeds are germinating, like that's a problem. We don't want that. But in theory, if you can get them up and you have a good strategy for destroying them, that will really reduce the seed bank over time. So some of the work that I did, I worked in rice, which is not wheat. It's also a grass. And a lot of the, you know, weed problems that we have in grass crops are grass weeds. So that's about all the knowledge that I carried from rice to wheat with me. But we did something in rice where we had a stale seed bed technique. And that's essentially where pre-season, you try to stimulate as much weed growth as possible. And then you, you know, you do tillage or you burn it down with a herbicide. In rice, we could sometimes add like a really, really deep flood. And then all of those weeds would die from the anaerobic conditions. So that's kind of an example of like why you would exploit those germination withdrawals from the seed bank.
So I guess my question would be, as you're looking at the environments, in my mind, I see the region you're working at UC Davis a little bit more stable as far as temperature, cold, warm, or not. And then you move into the instability of the plains. And we say Oklahoma, but it's really the whole plains region has this instability.
Yeah.
Is that helpful, challenging? What does that do? I can see it being all the above.
Helpful is not the word I would use. Challenging is definitely the word. So the thing that people don't realize about that Mediterranean climate is that they have two seasons. Mm-hmm. They have a hot, dry summer season, which is perfect for growing vegetables, you know, any kind of crop, because there's no pests, right? If you don't have water, you don't have pests. And then they have a cold. It never freezes in California unless you're like up in the Sierras, you know. Yeah. But then they have a cold, wet winter with a lot of snow melt that does actually feed down into a lot of California. Mm-hmm. Here in Oklahoma, just like you said, you know, it was frozen last week and I went out and played in shorts yesterday, you know. So so it is very complicated here. But the important thing to remember about weed seed management and about like all seeds in general, if you're a homeowner and you're trying to grow things from seed, all seeds are beholden to their environment. Like they will not germinate and emerge and grow and develop if they do not have the right environmental conditions. Now, not all seeds need light. They don't need oxygen, but all seeds need good temperature. They have a range and they need some amount of moisture. And so when we do germination experiments, that's kind of where we start. Like how hot is hot? How cold is cold? And if you can determine that range and those thresholds, you can sort of pin down when is this plant going to be growing and when isn't. Now there is another layer of moisture, like temperature and moisture are interactive factors when you're talking about seed germination, and they have to be studied in combination. But then, you know, some seeds need light. Like they will not germinate without light. Some seeds really need oxygen. You know, anaerobic germination is very, very rare. Some seeds really need nitrogen. So it's, you know, it gets more and more complicated, but those baseline determinators of is it going to germinate or not are really moisture and temperature.
So a curiosity on my side, when we look at it, and it's always been intriguing to me, we have a field and we get a good flush of weed seed due to a rainfall, this or that.
Yeah.
And we don't really do anything to the field, but we can get secondary and tertiary and however many flushes. How does that occur? How is it in the seed itself, like the plants just plant out to have different characteristics within the plant so that you have more spread, Or is it, you know, can you spend a little bit about that?
It's very complicated. And it's so funny to try to model this type of stuff, you know, because I did some like emergence modeling for my PhD. And I think my models were like 45% correct, you know, and I had like six site years of data, you know, and it's like, that was good. That was a good predictor, you know. The thing with a lot of our weed seeds is that they are opportunists, right? And so if they're buried very deep in the soil, that's a lot of soil to traverse to find the light. I was reading this really interesting paper yesterday as well, where our grasses, because of the way their cotyledon is shaped, it's easier for them to like emerge through the soil very quickly. Our broad leaves, right? They have like curlier cotyledons and they won't germinate from deeper depths. However, some of our annual grasses, because they've adapted themselves to this annual life cycle, their objective is to germinate and make as many seeds as possible. If they're not in that top half inch, the top half inch is really where a lot of our seeds are going to be very, very productive. If they're not in that top half inch, they're probably also not going to germinate because there's less heat, right? There's less moisture like infiltrating through the soil, depending on your soil type. but it's very nuanced. So the reason in what my thought is, the reason that we get a lot of secondary flushes is somehow that one little raindrop, it rained just a little bit more and that moisture infiltrated right in that very specific spot where that one seed was. And I think it's also really fascinating to think about systems with a lot of residue. So you're holding, like the idea of all that residue is that you're holding the moisture, but then how does that influence the proximity to weed seeds? You know, if there's a lot of residue in these rows and then the weed seeds are in between, are they getting more direct rainfall, which then stimulates germination? The other really fascinating thing too that I think a lot of people don't realize is we don't have a good way to measure dormancy. Yeah. So when a seed breaks dormancy, the only way that we can, well, without like a multi-million dollar machine, the only way that we can measure dormancy breaking is by doing a germination test. And if you do a germination test and it doesn't germinate, you know, your first assumption is like, oh, this seed might be unviable, but in reality, it's just not ready to germinate. And so there's also this additional layer of dormancy breaking, which is its own wild frontier of temperature, moisture, light, oxygen, you know, tillage, air circulation, you know.
And within the seeds of a single plant, whether it's Italian rye or cheap Rome or amaranth, would you expect there to be differences in dormancy from all the seeds from a single plant?
So,
I could potentially say it across plants, but would you see that there could be differences in a single plant?
You know, that's actually a genetics question. My first thought is no, but then also the ripening process, you know, if those seeds get knocked off the plant earlier than some other seeds, like the higher, what is it? Some of our, we used to call it rip gut brome. That's the Tectorum, Bromus Tectorum, has a very low shattering rate, which means it hangs on to the stem for a long time. And that ensures that that seed gains as much nutrients so that it can then go into the soil. So my thought is you could have that type of stratification with germination if the seeds get knocked off earlier, because they still kind of have to go through that maturation process.
I've always just wondered that, is like, you know, how many components could be in this system where we're getting so many flushes? How much is genetic? How much is, you know, maybe it's a little bit different depth of seed code because where it was on the plant at? I mean, there's so many different variables, and how many of these could be almost naturally created so that that plant species is guaranteeing multiple germination points for a higher probability of success? And how much have we mechanically increased that variability within that by one or two timings, or we multiple flushes has now come to being a successful weed in our systems?
Yeah. And I, I also wonder if like drought contributes to that as well, because that ripening process, heat increases metabolism a lot of times. And so, some of our brome species, they will not only accelerate their growth so that their seeds can like ripen, they will double down on their seed production. And so you brought up a really good point with like seed coats. I think in droughty years, we're probably going to see thicker seed coats because that seed is trying to retain moisture. But then does a thicker seed coat equate to a longer dormancy period? But it's also an annual species. And so its life cycle objective is not necessarily dormancy. You know what I'm saying? So, I've talked to a lot of growers about Italian ryegrass, Lolea multiflorum. People love to talk to me about Italian ryegrass. And, a lot of the literature says all across the U.S., it's highly adaptive, but the general assumption is that its dormancy is only about 3 years or less. Now, I talked to a grower down in Carnegie at the beginning of the year that was like, I think I saw Italian ryegrass 7 years after I stopped growing wheat. He said he saw it in a pattern, which I was kind of like, okay, so something happened. But I wouldn't discount that, like there's these little factors in the soil that can like, maybe they held on to some anaerobic pockets in the soil, and so a lack of oxygen increased that viability.
I mean, the Italian ryegrass problems are heavily, well, not heavily, but we hear most of it out of the Southeast, much more moisture, much more high rainfall, much more, biological activity within the soil system. Carnegie goes dry for long periods of time. So how much does 100 days without soil moisture influence dormancy or opportunity for dormancy or length of dormancy?
Length of dormancy. Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing too, that a lot of people don't think about is when you do these dormancy studies, like there have been, Chenopodium album, which is a lamb's quarter. There's been studies that have shown they can have a dormancy of like 120 years. Like somebody found them in a jar in a barn and germinated them. And they were like, why? So like the perfect storm of conditions can increase the dormancy of these seeds. And how am I, Liberty, with one lifetime to live, going to do these dormancy studies? there's like a million ways to do those studies and they're very rigorous. I would really like to do some, but I kind of take growers' words when they're like,
well, and I'm going to ask you this because this is the challenge and we have in the soil science realm too. To me, in these germination studies, as you've also said, is that a lot of the conditions to do the studies are really nice. I mean, they're pretty consistent and perfect. You look at the growth chamber studies for nitrogen cycling and carbon cycling, and we keep moistures constant. And then you go to Carnegie and say, okay, how is the germination study I did at Stillwater in a greenhouse growth chamber, how is that equating? How do you take the perfect scenario and then go to Western Oklahoma and say, okay, this is what we learned?
Well, I mean, that's a really, really good point. And I think a lot of researchers who are really heavy research get stuck into that kind of loop. That's sort of the beauty of the applied weed ecology. So when you do those studies, finding those thresholds is really important. So So I worked on weedy rice for my PhD, which is the same genus and species as cultivated rice. But weedy rice is a genetic combination of a lot of different things. And so the lower threshold for M206. It's like a variety that was developed at the Rice Research Station. M206 actually has a base temperature threshold of 10 degrees Celsius, but Wheaty Rice has a base temperature of 15 degrees Celsius. So these seeds have different limits. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you really have to determine is, where are the edges of these limits? So when you do these studies, it's not just what are the ideal conditions, it's how stressed, how like water stressed and heat stressed can we make these seeds before they like literally mold and melt in the petri dish. I have melted some seeds. 45 degrees Celsius is hot. and they'll melt after 3 days at that temperature.
That's impressive.
There's a lot of parafilm, you know, that parafilm cracks every 6 hours and you got to get back in there and hold the moisture and, you know.
We have accidentally put soil and paper bags into an oven in an underground, turned it up to the wrong level, thinking the difference between Celsius and Fahrenheit. And so we have caught paper. Well, we smoldered paper bags of soil.
Yeah. Gently caught on fire.
All right. So I've got a couple points, because we're already running out of time like we tend to, I think, Liberty. So this is something that we've spoken on, and I've said, sometimes I say comments along this just to trigger some good discussion, but I do think there's potential here. So as a point, what are the potential effects of tillage on weed management in a long-term no-till field?
Yeah, this is something that a lot of people have talked to me about in the last 6 months. There's a lot of diesel and steel. We're going to get rid of our herbicide-resistant weeds with diesel and steel. It's like, all right, okay, relax. I hear you. But valid, because Dr. Shreshtha and I have been doing a lot of herbicide-resistant weed surveys across the state of Oklahoma. We got 200 samples submitted to us, and we've run about 100, and we're finding glyphosate resistant Italian ryegrass, group one, group two, you know, all this different stuff. So it's valid that people want to go back to tillage. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of our soil loving colleagues, friends, I don't know if they're our colleagues, but our friends, they like to forget about the fact that no-till was made available because of the rise in herbicide-tolerant crop technology. Those technologies are incredible, in my opinion. Like, what a feat of agronomy to create herbicide-tolerant technologies, but we overuse them. Mm-hmm. And doing an occasional tillage event, I think would be a great way to manage those weeds. Now the big thing though is, you know, I just started working with a kid. He's my undergrad employee, but he has a family farm, like really close to Enid, close to the Kansas border. And he was like, we have a field that's been in no-till for 2 years, for 5 years, for 10 and 20, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we're going to kind of work with him, but, to kind of see like, hey, what's lurking at 6 inches, you know?
I love that.
I read a really, really good paper recently that is not yet published, but I'll send it to you once it's published. They did a very similar study where they took soil cores down to 6 inches and they're looking at what's at each inch. Now, what I want to do is a similar experiment, but then spray them with herbicides, right?
Yeah,
if we have because when you do no-till, all of your seeds fall to the surface. They're no longer getting incorporated. And so if everybody's having trouble with herbicide-resistant Italian ryegrass, its optimal germination depth is a half inch burial depth, right? Mm-hmm. If we flip all of that, are we going to find herbicide resistant Italian ryegrass from 20 years ago? Probably not. But this paper that I read was talking about the kind of the diversity of the weeds that we find in the soil. And from a weed ecology perspective, it's actually more ideal to have a diversity of weeds. I know from a management perspective, that's not great, but what we do with selection pressure is we select for the nastiest weeds that are really hard to manage. So I think there's some interesting implications with like herbicide resistant management, but then also diversifying our problems, and they'll end up fighting with each other. You know what I'm saying? Instead of just this one nasty weed in our crop fighting, the weed seeds themselves will have a harder time being successful.
Okay. So I'm actually a big proponent of this to a degree. I like the concept of inversion tillage. I don't like the mixing. I think the disc and chisel is not the option. This needs to be an inversion. Flip it, bury it, open up new on a long rotation. I think that soil health and quality parameters won't be that negatively impacted from the research we've done. But my question and quandary, this is the devil's advocate, as we're running out of time, my greatest fear is fence rows and borders. Because we still have all that problem in every border area, and all in does flipping the field and not managing the, or even the highway, you know, how much have we, I hear about going out in the high plains and okay, so I manage my field, but the bar ditch is filled with amaranth. It's filled with all the bad things.
Yeah.
And so that's like the offset is like, okay, what, you know, how much outside of the field control is needed to actually aid it? And we don't have a lot of time, but give me a minute.
If you want a really clean field, it does matter what your neighbor's doing, what's happening in the ditch, what you're doing to your side roads. You know, I talked to a person recently that said they took out a whole chunk of their field from no-till because their neighbors are sloppy, quite frankly. And, you know, you do the best that you can, and maybe you try to harvest the middle first before you harvest the outside, you know, like in an ideal world that looks different than the world we live in. So that's a multi-stakeholder project is what that is.
It's time for our famous three. Explore the future of agriculture with KWS, a global leader in innovation and sustainable farming practices. Uncover the exceptional qualities of our hybrid rye, cultivating a legacy for a greener tomorrow. Visit kws.com/US for more information and for dealer locations. KWS, seeding the future since 1856.
All right, Liberty, we've already asked these, but we're going to go, you've answered them before, I'm going to hit them again. I've kind of contemplated where we do this, but what is a go-to work resource for you? When you have questions and quandaries in your realm, where do you go?
So questions and quandaries in my realm. People ask me all the time about weeds that I'm not familiar with. And I love a good fact sheet. It doesn't have to be from Oklahoma State. You know, I love a good regional fact sheet. Josh Bichong and I have been talking about a weed ID guide that actually Case Medlin published. I want to add vegetative pictures to it, and that's kind of like a glove box guide. So I'm trying to get more of these like hands-on things into people's hands, but they also help me a lot. Like these ID guides are very helpful. Yeah.
I still use the field guides that I created 15 years ago. I flip back to it. Just because you write it doesn't mean you remember it all the time. You need resources.
Yeah.
So what do you do in your free time, Larry? Because you have a lot. I know you're just, you know,
all over the place. I just moved into a new house. So what I've been doing in my free time is painting cabinets. I'm an avid gardener, and actually my biggest gardening accomplishment of 2024 was I grew 18 lemons on a bonsai lemon tree at my home. Yeah. Thank you.
I've killed many of those.
So. I'm really proud. Yeah.
And finally, where do people go to find out more about your research and extension program?
So I started a Facebook page last fall. And I try to post original content. It's just me on there saying like, hey, look at this cool weed that I found this week, you know? And you can find me on Facebook at OK State Weed Science. There's also my OK State, experts.okstate.edu page, which has like my bio and my publications. And I'm on LinkedIn. But I think Facebook is a lot more fun if you're trying to see like what I'm up to on the day to day.
I've been enjoying that. You've been doing a great job on that.
Thank you.
That wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wyzenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Dr. Liberty Gallup, Assistant Professor of Extension Weed Science and Precision Weed Management at Oklahoma State University. Now, y'all, if you enjoyed this, click subscribe to the channel so that you can get notifications whenever we drop a new podcast. Share the video with your friends and peers if you learned something and enjoyed our conversation today. Of course, leave us any comments and suggestions you may have. Liberty, thank you so much for joining. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate the invite.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.